The Guardian.
Philippe Sands QC is Professor of International Law at University College London and one of Britain's leading human rights lawyers. His new book, Torture Team, Deception, Cruelty and the Compromise of Law, looks at how prisoners at Guantanamo Bay were subjected to interrogation methods. So, Philippe, first of all, tell us how you put this book together.
Well, I'd written another book 3 years ago called Lawless World, which dealt more generally with the rule of law internationally. I wanted to know how Prime Minister Tony Blair and President George Bush had gone about undoing various international rules that a lot of people around the world care about. And one of the chapters dealt with Guantanamo, and in passing, I dealt with this same material. But I was intrigued by the material, and I felt I probably hadn't done it justice by just devoting a single chapter to it. And what I've come to learn in practice as a lawyer is that at the end of the day, nothing beats talking to the actual people who are involved in decision making and finding out what really happened. And I had a niggling concern that the people who'd been scapegoated for what had happened at Guantanamo, a guy called Major General Mike Dunleavy, who was the combatant commander and described by Jim Haynes before the Senate Judiciary Committee as an aggressive major general, and his lawyer Diane Beaver, that something didn't smell right, that these ideas and these decisions could have come from these people, was counterintuitive. So I went to speak to them. I tracked them down. I found them. I spent many hours talking to them. And, of course, what I discovered was that my instinct had been right, that, in fact, they'd been subject to extraordinary pressures that had come from the top. And so I went up the food chain. I went up the chain of command. I met with General Hill. I met with General Myers. I met with Doug Feith. I met with Jim Haynes. And the full story emerged in the spate of a series of conversations. A lot of people have asked me, why on earth did these people speak to you? And that's a question I've thought about long and hard. I think in part it must be that I'm not an American. I was coming from the outside. I'm an academic, and I made undertakings to treat all the material fairly. But also, I'm not a journalist. I'm a lawyer, a barrister, and perhaps in the United States, being a barrister, being a Queen's Counsel, had a certain cachet. And I was astonished that everyone I asked to speak with agreed to meet with me. Everyone spoke very frankly. Jim Haynes wouldn't speak on the record. He perhaps spoke a little less frankly. Perhaps one day it will emerge how our conversation went. But it was a remarkable process, and I think a mark of the remarkable society that the United States is, that not armed with a subpoena, with no funding to support my investigation, really done as a personal initiative, I got access across the board and discovered what I think is a rather remarkable story.
So what were these new interrogation techniques used at Guantanamo that breached guidelines contained in the US Army's field manual?
Well, in June 2002, the camp commandant at Guantanamo discovered that amongst the 700 or so detainees was detainee number 063, who turned out to be a man called Mohammed Al-Qahtani, a man of Saudi nationality who was thought to be the 20th hijacker. They felt that this was a man who may have information. Existing and established techniques of interrogation produced no results, as I was told. And so in August 2002, they began the process of looking for new techniques of interrogation. And ultimately, on the 2nd of December 2002, Donald Rumsfeld authorized a list of 15 new techniques of interrogation out of 18. These techniques were divided into three categories. Category one was the simplest, yelling. Category two essentially went to issues of humiliation and degradation of a psychological character. It included hooding, standing, forced nudity, grooming, cutting off people's hair, the use of dogs. And then you had category three, of which just one out of the four techniques were approved for blanket use by Donald Rumsfeld. But amongst the four, and kept open for later possible use, was waterboarding. So these went way beyond what the U.S. field manual had allowed. And of course, it's important to recall that since 1863, since the time of President Abraham Lincoln, the U.S. military had forborne the use of cruelty in any way whatsoever in relation to any person at any time. So this was a historic and very marked change of direction.
How and why were these rules changed?
Well, the rules were changed because it was felt that the existing techniques were unlikely to produce results. The existence of these new techniques of interrogation emerged in June 2004 when the administration was on the defensive in relation to the appalling photographs that emerged in relation to Abu Ghraib. And the administration spun a narrative which basically said, we don't do abuse, we don't do torture. Abu Ghraib was about a few rotten eggs, junior people, nothing to do with the policy of the administration. And to support that, they put in the public domain a number of documents, which are the focus of the book and of my investigations meeting people around America, which are intended to show that the request for changes for new types of interrogation techniques came from the ground level, came from Guantanamo, trickled upwards, and eventually reached the upper echelons of the administration and were approved because, as I was put, it was the right thing to do. The investigation that I engaged in and the journey that I made around America, meeting and talking to just about everybody involved in that decision-making process, showed, I think, conclusively that the story was totally different. It was top-down. It was a decision that was taken from the office of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld himself. It was imposed on people on the ground floor under extraordinary pressures. And at the heart of the whole operation were the most senior lawyers in the administration.
So you mentioned Donald Rumsfeld there. How close was George Bush to all of this?
The approval of individual interrogation techniques used on Muhammad al-Qahtani can be traced directly to the offices of the President of the United States, George Bush, to the Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney, and to the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. And the clearest connection is through their lawyers. There was an extraordinary meeting held in September 2002, just before the techniques were going to go up the chain of command, so to speak, at which President Bush's lawyer, Alberto Gonzalez, President Cheney's lawyer, David Addington, and Donald Rumsfeld's lawyer, Jim Haynes, descended on Guantanamo, met with the combatant commander there, Mike Dunleavy, watched some interrogations, and as I was told by Dunleavy and by his lawyer, Diane Beaver, basically sent out the signal, do whatever needs to be done.
So were senior members of the American military aware that the strict ban on the cruel and inhumane treatment of prisoners had been lifted?
Well, I've learned a lot about how the U.S. military functions, and I have to say that one group of people who comes out of my book, I think, if not quite smelling like roses, then certainly enhanced in my view, are the military lawyers. And the U.S. military, who operate really to the highest standards of professionalism, integrity, and to very strict rules. Essentially, in order to move forward these techniques of interrogation, the Department of Defense, the Secretary of Defense, had to bypass the military lawyers, and they had to bypass the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Myers. And they did that in the following way. The techniques, which were the result of pressure brought from the top, emerged from Guantanamo, made their way to the head of Southern Command in Miami, General Hill, and from General Hill then made their way directly to the office of the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Myers. And I met with all of those people, General Hill and General Myers. What then happened was that the normal decision-making process was short-circuited. General Myers's lawyer, a lady called Jane Dalton, did not have the opportunity to finish the assessment process because, as she told another lawyer in the Navy, Jim Haynes intervened, took the papers away, short-circuited the process, and moved the matter directly to the Secretary of Defense for his approval and signature, which, of course, he did, scrawling the famous little handwritten note, "Why standing limited to 4 hours when I stand for 8 to 10 hours a day?" A scrawl that I suspect one day may get Donald Rumsfeld into very real trouble. But the upshot of all of this was that Donald Rumsfeld's lawyer, Jim Haynes, short-circuited the process, and the normal decision-making process for the military, including the military lawyers, was avoided, as a result of which a decision could be taken by Secretary Rumsfeld.
General Richard Myers, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, believed that terror suspects held at Guantanamo Bay and other prisons were protected by the Geneva Conventions. You say in your book that General Myers was tricked.
Well, this was one of the more startling discoveries that I'd met. I'd put considerable effort into finding and speaking with everyone who'd been involved in the decision-making process. And I was enormously grateful to people, including very senior people like Richard Myers, for making time and speaking with me. And I spent a number of hours with him in Washington. We spoke on the record. I found him to be a very decent man, and I thought that he spoke with great honesty and integrity. But it was plain that he was not on top of the decisions that had been taken. The first step in the decision-making process by the administration was to get rid of the Geneva Conventions. And they did that by a decision of the president himself on the 7th of February 2002, when by executive decision, President Bush determined that none of the detainees at Guantanamo would have any rights under the Geneva Conventions. Now, that is a curious decision because no country has played a greater role in the promotion of the Geneva Conventions, and no country has a military that's more supportive of the Geneva Conventions than the United States. President Bush made that determination, it turned out, on the advice of the Department of Justice, and in particular with the involvement of the number three at the Department of Defense, a rather colorful character by the name of Doug Feith. Doug Feith basically put forward his legal theories on why Geneva didn't apply. They were given effect. When I met with General Myers, who explained to me the vital importance of Geneva in his beliefs, I was rather surprised to discover that General Myers had proceeded on the basis that Geneva had applied and that the decision had been taken to apply the Geneva Conventions. And when I pointed out to him that the decision was to disapply the Geneva Conventions, he was somewhat surprised. But my own surprise at that discovery was as nothing compared to what I learnt next. When we turned, General Myers and I, to look at the individual techniques of interrogation that I've just described to you, I asked him for an explanation as to how he, as a military man, could support the use of these techniques when, obviously, as he put it to me, he would object strongly if these techniques of interrogation were used on Americans. And he proceeded to explain to me that these techniques came out of the book. And I asked which book, and he said the field manual. And that was a big surprise because they didn't. The field manual explicitly prohibits precisely these types of techniques. It was, I would say, shocking to me that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs was unaware that these were new techniques, that these were techniques that were banned by the U.S. manual of military law, and that the techniques had been concocted to deal with the peculiarities of a single person. I think it indicated, as one person described it to me, that General Myers had been well and truly hoodwinked by the senior echelons of the Bush administration.
Now, the Vice President, Dick Cheney, has publicly defended the use of waterboarding. Apart from the immediate effects on the prisoners themselves, what's been the significance of the change in policy?
Well, Dick Cheney has referred positively about, I think, what he calls a dunk in the water. I don't know if our listeners would be aware of what waterboarding actually is, but it is the process of creating in a detainee the misperception of suffocation through the introduction of water in the mouth and the nose, and the use of cloths, which make it impossible for people to breathe. It's a pretty shocking technique to use. I've got no doubt that it amounts to torture. It wasn't used, I think, on Mohammed al-Qahtani. It was used by the CIA, as President Bush's group has admitted, on a number of CIA detainees. I think the fact that the United States has moved to these techniques of interrogation at all is deeply disturbing. There has been no country in the world that has done more for the promotion of the rule of law and human rights than the United States. By abandoning the Geneva constraints, by abandoning the prohibitions on the in the convention prohibiting torture, the United States has made it much easier for other regimes and for other governments to move to precisely these techniques in their activities. I work also as a barrister. I do cases around the world for many governments. I've been in a room with a president of another government who has whipped out one of the legal advices that Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush relied on, justifying these types of actions, and said to me, look, this is the legal advice that allows this to happen. If the Americans can do it, why can't we? It has vitally undermined U.S. moral authority. It has made it much more difficult to promote the rule of law and human rights internationally, and it needs to come to an end, and it needs to come to an end quickly.
How closely involved were senior members of the Bush administration with the ill-treatment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq?
I think, as I've described, in relation to Guantanamo, they were directly involved in the sense that decision-making went to the highest levels of the administration. When you've got Donald Rumsfeld's lawyer, Jim Haines, the vice president's lawyer, David Addington, and the president's lawyer, Alberto Gonzalez, directly involved in the decision-making process, you establish the potential personal responsibility of these individuals. And let's just be absolutely clear about what personal responsibility means here. A violation of Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, which prohibits all of these techniques used in this way, gives rise to the possibility of war crimes. And it's not my claim that is made there. When the United States Supreme Court finally intervened in July 2006 and said that the administration had got it wrong, that Geneva applied, that Common Article 3 applied, Justice Anthony Kennedy went out of his way to say, and the failure of the United States to follow Common Article 3 exposes individuals to war crimes investigations. So the consequences are very serious of approving this type of stuff, and it puts directly within the frame not only the upper echelon decision makers, but also their lawyers. Now, the big question, of course, that arises is, does the responsibility extend beyond what happened at Guantanamo? And the question, of course, is whether these techniques of interrogation migrated beyond Guantanamo to other places, and in particular to Abu Ghraib. Three official investigations by United States bodies have concluded that there was migration from Guantanamo. The migration occurred through the personnel from Guantanamo who went to visit Abu Ghraib in August 2003, both the combatant commander, the new one at Guantanamo, Major General Jeffrey Miller, and his lawyer, Diane Beaver. The techniques that were approved for use in Iraq and at Abu Ghraib were remarkably similar to the techniques that were approved for use at Guantanamo: hooding, stress positions, dogs, and related matters. And I think, at the very least, it becomes clear that there was sanction and approval of the use of these techniques at the highest levels, and this opened the door to a culture and an environment in which other forms of abuse, including the ones that are depicted in photographs at Abu Ghraib, came to occur. And this was described to me very clearly by a psychologist who was based at Guantanamo, Mike Gellison, who was very strongly opposed to the move to abusive techniques of interrogation. He said to me, Philippe, the thing is, we've learned as psychologists of a phenomenon known as force drift. Once you accept that a little bit of force is justified in one circumstance, you move on to an acceptance that even more force may be justified in another circumstance. And in that way, the danger of migration was predicted by those who opposed these techniques in September, October, November 2002, and their predictions came true.
Now, some will find this an incredible revelation, another incredible revelation. You say in your book that interrogation at Guantanamo even got ideas from the TV series 24.
This was one of the more extraordinary moments of my conversation with Diane Beaver, who was the lawyer at Guantanamo. I met with her several times. I concluded that she was not a member of the torture team, as I've characterized them. She was essentially scapegoated. She was put in a position she should never have been put in being asked to do some of these things. But during the course of our conversation, I wrote down a note. I wrote down on a piece of paper, 24, Becca. It rang no bells. I didn't know what she was referring to. I went back to my hotel room after I'd met with her in Washington. I typed out my notes, which was my practice. And when I came to 24, Becca, it didn't ring any bells. I didn't know what she was talking about. So I typed into my laptop, 24, Becca, Googled it. And what came back was 24, do you mean 24 Jack Bauer? So I went and looked at what 24 Jack Bauer was, and that was how I learned for the first time about this television series, which is premised on the assumption that the use of torture is a good thing because it produces results. So in my next conversation with Diane Beaver, I asked her about Jack Bauer, and she proceeded to explain to me that, yes, indeed, 24, the Fox television series, was broadcast into Guantanamo, and everyone watched it on cable. It was hugely popular, she said. 24, I think, as she put it, had many friends at Guantanamo. And, of course, the timing is remarkable. The second series of 24 went to air in the last week of October 2002. And at the very moment these techniques were being approved, I went and bought the series, sat down with my son, put in the DVD, watched the opening sequence of series 2 of 24, and it opens with a scene of an individual being tortured and speaking as a consequence of the torture being used. And you can see in this way how popular culture astonishingly just played in to individual decision-making directly on the ground in Guantanamo. And what's very striking is that you then find that individuals like Michael Chertoff, who's now head of Homeland Security, but who was in the Criminal Justice Division in the Department of Justice at the time, is a great fan of 24s. And if you also look at the Supreme Court judgment that I referred to earlier in relation to the application of Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, there were two dissents on that question, did the Geneva Conventions apply at Guantanamo? Justice Antonin Scalia and Justice Clarence Thomas. And what do you discover? These two men are great fans of the television series 24. So it's a remarkable circle that is created.
Do we know whether any of those techniques learned from 24 resulted in any information?
Well, I don't think that any of the techniques that were used, certainly the program that I watched on 24, were actually used on any detainees at Guantanamo. But what 24 did was create an environment in which popular culture basically said, there's no problem doing this sort of stuff. It works. You're with us. You're part of this whole system. So proceed. Did it produce any results? I tracked down the head of Mohammed al-Qahtani's exploitation team, a very impressive guy called Cal Temple, who worked for a body called the Defense Intelligence Agency. And what I learned was that the interrogations of Mohammed al-Qahtani were transmitted in live time, in real time, by audio, and I think in some cases by video, to Washington. And a team of interrogation experts then reviewed what was going on and participated from a distance in the interrogation. I asked Cal Temple, did you get anything out of Al-Qahtani? And the answer that he gave me, contextual information, historical information, indicated to me rather clearly that they got nothing out of Muhammad Al-Qahtani. And I describe in the book, in much more detail, that the evidence is clear that nothing useful was obtained. And of course, this goes back again to the views of those at Guantanamo, in the military, in the FBI, in the Naval Criminal Investigation Service, who strongly and vigorously opposed the abusive interrogation of Al-Qahtani and who said, it doesn't work, it's not going to produce results, we mustn't do this.
You've discovered a whole world that we didn't know about before. Are there any questions that still need answering?
Oh, I think there are a lot of questions that others are going to have to follow up on. I mean, I was giving tidbits of information that intrigued me enormously. I refer to them in the book. I end the book with a reference to something Mike Dunleavy told me. As he and I met, it was plain he was becoming increasingly concerned that he had really been scapegoated and that he had not been fully aware of the extent of the decision-making process. And he described to me how he had tried to go back to get hold of some of the material that had been safeguarded on computers and video links and audio links and everything. And he told me it had all gone. There was a snafu, he said. It's been destroyed. And that, of course, immediately opened to my mind the possibility that with Guantanamo might have happened what has happened with the CIA interrogations, namely the destruction of the videotapes showing abusive interrogation and torture under U.S. hands of certain individuals. That's going to have to be for others to investigate, but it's pretty clear to me that the story that I tell explodes the narrative that the administration has wanted to push, that this was a bottom-up thing. They were just reacting as a prudent, cautious government to what people on the ground were saying. That's not what happened. It came from the top. It was a curious and unhappy blend of ideology and incompetence that has dishonored the United States.
Philippe Sands, thanks very much. And Torture Team, Deception, Cruelty and the Compromise of Law is published by Alan Lane.
For more discussion and analysis, download Guardian Daily. That's The Guardian's news podcast, available first thing in the morning, Monday to Friday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.